Welcome to the Drum History Podcast. I am your host, Bart Vanderzee, and today I'm joined by Ron Weinstein, who is the originator of Tuxedo Gig Bags. Ron, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Bart.
Yes. We've been talking for a while. That seems to be a theme on the show recently, where I'm kind of getting a lot of people such as yourself, where we've been talking for about a year almost. In September, it'll be a year. And we're finally making it happen. And I want to say really quickly, thank you to Greg Chatterinek. I'm sorry about butchering your last name, who sent me a nice message and copy and pasted basically a very cool story that Ron told on the Slingerland Sets and Snare Drums Facebook group. And that prompted this whole thing. And now here we are today to kind of really dig deeper into the origins of Tuxedo Bags. So all that being said, Ron, why don't you just go back to the beginning and how did all this start?
Well, the Tuxedo start happened around 1981. I was living in Las Vegas, and I had the usual gripe a lot of guys had with cymbal bags, where they would rip out. Cymbal edges eventually would always eat through the bottom of a cymbal bag. And at that time, I knew this girl that sold industrial fabrics. She was a representative. And like, she sold the Nomex to Simpson Racing for those fireproof suits.
Wow, yeah.
And she says, there's a new fabric out, and brand new, and it was called Cordura by DuPont that she represented. And they had a second version called Antron Cordura, which made it a very smooth and shiny finish and not the stubbly finish like on most Corduras today that you see. So I said, wow, now that stuff is really strong. It was waterproof, coated on one side, and you couldn't rip it at all. And I said, this could really work out. There are things I'd like to design a little bag that I think I could use. I said, okay. So I said, here's what I want to do. We got some of this fabric. And I said, well, a lot of times the handles, the straps always rip out in Naugahyde and canvas also, because they die out. So we got, at that time also was brand new, was like nylon seatbelt webbing. Nobody was really using it for luggage and all that stuff. And the plastic buckles that look like seatbelt buckles, you know, that you see on all luggage today that lock into each other.
Sure.
Nobody was using those. So I said, well, let me design something. We made it also so the straps, once you had the handle on the cymbal bag, the straps were also sewn straight down from where they attached the handle and went around the bottom of the bag up to the other side. I said, well, this is going to hold all the weight you could possibly imagine.
Yeah, because cymbals are heavy. I mean, when you have a bag full of cymbals, it can weigh, I mean, I feel like it's like 20.
Could be 20, 30 pounds.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I said, well, this would never rip out. And the sharp edge of the cymbal, you know, normally would rip out the bottom too. Not only would this cradle the cymbals, we also, before we sewed the two halves of the cymbal bag together, we ran that seatbelt webbing all around between the two halves. So the edge of the cymbal would rest on that nylon webbing also. So this was really like a solid bag. And I said, well, you know, this is really cool. We had one made by someone that she sold the fabric to, was an industrial sewing company. And they made me a sample of the bag, and I tried it out, and I said, wow, this is going to work. And did a few refinements size-wise and, you know, and a lining. We put laminated some foam to an inside nylon lining. So all that gets pressed together, and then you sew the bag. So at that time, I said, well, what if I use this stuff for a stick bag also? Okay. So we made a pretty normal stick bag, but with the nylon handle. But the unique thing, I had another idea. I said, one thing I don't like about these stick bags, when you go to strap it onto your floor tom-tom, you know, there's those straps that come out the side.
Yep.
And they were elastic with an S-hook.
Yeah, exactly.
And you put the S-hook through the lug, you know, and that could scratch the drum. but also depending on how much weight you had in the stick bag, it would move up and down. Yeah. I said, well, here's this. Let's take the thinner, let's take the seatbelt webbing and attach Velcro on the end with a piece of Velcro where it attached, and then sew that to the bag. And that way, A, it wouldn't stretch, and B, you could loop it through the lug and attach it to itself, and you couldn't scratch anything. Hmm. So we did that. No one had done that before. Man. So we made a symbol bag and a stick bag, and that was the start of it.
I love the attention to detail early on. I mean, that you're so right, though, about, like, you know, you have this $2,000 drum set and that little kind of piece of metal that comes up from a normal traditional stick bag that wraps around your little, you know, around the lug, around the tension rod there. It's mm-hmm. then it's ruining your drum finish. It's like a rash. I mean, it's kind of like if you don't protect your bass drum hoop with a bass drum pedal, it's ruined. Well, so I want to obviously move forward here, but before we move forward, let me ask you the question too. You mentioned that there was some predecessors, like you said Naugahyde, correct? What was the, I know we know it's stick bags that kind of scratch your drum, but what were people using before this? Before we go forward, like what was, as far as cymbal bags and all that kind of stuff, what were you improving upon at that point?
Well, besides the Naugahyde that would crack and dry out and rip, before that there were like drum bags and stuff were sort of like a canvas. Hmm. And that's all they had. And they really didn't have any padding in them. You just covered your bag. And other than that, fiber cases.
Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah. Which would be like, you know, which are not, I mean, even today, it's more heavy duty. I mean, the fiber kind of like, those are like more hard road cases, clearly, right? Like those are for, yeah, it's a little different than just putting your drum in a bag. I mean, that's a case.
Right. The fiber cases were kind of thin, you know, it was made out of whatever they used. It wasn't plastic, you know, it was some kind of fiber. And you usually, I remember years ago when I first got one, you had to like spray, you had to shellac them because if they were out in the rain, forget it. They were no good.
Yeah.
You know, so that's what people used on the road. They used fiber cases.
Yeah. And that happened for a long time. I actually kind of funny side note story, and then we'll carry on from there. But I was going to the University of Cincinnati here, the music school there for audio engineering and stuff. And so I was doing a lot with music. Up the street from my house, there was a bar that had a big parking lot, and we would, you know, go to the bar and hang out and stuff. But one day I was kind of going down the hill to my house, and I looked over and I went, there's an entire set of those like fiber kind of old vintagey drum cases sitting in the parking lot. And I was like, in no way, I'm not the kind of guy where I'm like, oh, that's mine, I'm taking it. But I think I was like, okay, whoa. I think I went home and like 4 or 5 hours later, because I figured maybe a band was playing there and they left them and, you know, they would come back for them. But I kind of thought later, if it was like, you know, half the day, like later, then okay, they're not coming back. They must have gone, and there's probably no way to get them. So anyway, I drove up. I picked them up. I was looking at them. I did look if there was like a name or something, and I wanted to see if I could return them. But they were nice. It was bass drum. It was two toms. It was a snare. It was, you know, the floor tom case. But all of the straps were
rotted out.
They were like, it was like they had just been like snapped, and they were frayed. But the kicker that was not good was they were sewn and connected to the case, so there was no real replacing them. You'd have to use like a bungee or something, but it just, even that technology then, which they seemed like they were from, I mean, at that point, this was 2010 or 2012 or something. So they must
they were actually probably riveted to the case.
They were riveted to the case. So I'm assuming they were from the 90s or from the 80s or something. They were just someone's dads who they gave them to him, and then they played with them. They were shot. They were like not fixable. But I kept them for years and moved them from studio to studio, like us drummers do when we just move.
I recently repaired some fiber cases for that same reason.
Really?
Believe it or not.
Wow.
Yeah, what I did real quick, I had a couple of of like my a bass drum fiber case where the straps, you know, were ripped off. Okay, so what I did, I took out the rivets, and I went down to the to a thrift store, and I bought a couple for $1 each. I bought a couple of belts, black belts.
Yeah.
I cut the belt to the size I wanted, punched some holes in it, and drilled a couple holes and put in some new rivets. Nice. And I fixed it.
Probably looks nicer too than the old kind of nylon-y, like. That's funny because you're the tuxedo guy. You know, I've got to have a black belt for your tuxedo.
Yeah, because originally they were black leather straps.
Leather. Okay. Yeah.
And I fixed them.
Man. Well, you gotta, you know, it's better than throwing stuff away. I think I ended up selling the cases that I found like years later. I ended up selling them to someone who fixed them, I think for like $75 or $50, which, not bad, but all right. Anyway, back on the timeline here. So you had created a stick bag and a cymbal bag, where you're using the seatbelt material. You're using all this very modern, for the time material that no one else was using. So you're kind of like ahead of the curve. I love that you're looking at something and you see it and go, hey man, that could be that. I could use that for, you know, us drummers and it could change the game. So, what happened from there?
From there, I showed them to my mentor and advisor, Louis Belson. Louis, to me, is the all-time saint of drums.
Yes.
And we were very close from the time I was 16 years old, and I'll go back to that story later.
Sure.
I showed him to Louis. He dug him. He said, well, what we got to do, what was coming up then was the NAMM show in Los Angeles. And all the music merchants would be there. That's where everybody goes. So we said, let's go to the NAMM show. So Louis and I went there, and I had the one cymbal bag and one stick bag. And we showed them to a guy that Louis had known for years, Chuck Molinari. Chuck was Bob Yeager's partner. Bob Yeager and Chuck owned the Pro Drum Shop in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Now, Chuck had left Pro Drum Shop and opened up his own company called Spectra Sound Percussion, where he made wind chimes and a lot of percussion products. So we went to Chuck's booth, and of course, who was there, you know, besides Chuck? I remember there were some drummers there, because Louis knows everybody. We're all talking and looking, and they dug the bag. Well, Chuck turned to me and says, you know, are you making these? And I said, yeah, I could. He says, let me have 100 of each.
First order.
Yeah. I said, I turned to Louis, right? I said, I think I'm in business. I mean, I knew nothing about this. You know? And that was the start. Chuck, and he asked, could he have the exclusive for the first year distributorship or first 6 months or a year? I said, yeah, sure. I don't know anybody else. So I then went, bought the fabric and went to one of the contract sewers in LA. And I was living in Vegas at the time by then. And we made up those bags and I shipped them to Chuck. And he started getting some interest. People liked them. So the next NAMM show that came up, I think it was, I don't know if it was whose decision, it was my decision or Louis, whatever, that I would get my own booth. Because now, by this time, I had also made bags for the drums, too. Same fabric, same, almost the same construction, the nylon straps. And on the edge, instead of just sewing the edges together, we used a plastic welting inside. You know, it looks like a black strip that goes around the outside. You've seen on better products.
Yeah.
And on the inside, instead of where the two pieces meet, we put what's called a binding tape over that. So everything was covered. Everything was strong. And when I did, I got my own booth, little 10 by 10 booth at the next NAMM show. And I got a lot of interest. And what I would do to show how strong it was, I would have like a 6 by 6 inch square of that Antron nylon Cordura.
Yeah.
And I slit it with a scissor about 2 inches, and I would give that piece to somebody. I'd say, here, you see this? Try to tear it. Well, for once it started, it won't tear.
Wow.
You know, you could slit it with a scissor.
Sure.
But from there, with the, you grab the two halves, you can't tear it any further. It's rip-stop nylon.
Wow.
So I said, at the time, originally I said, and I'm the way these straps are sewn on, I'm guaranteeing this bag for life. Well, everybody told me, don't do that. That's not a good idea. But I was that confident. I said, look, you could stand on a bag. I had a bag. They could stand on a drum bag and pull on the handle while the bag was under their feet, and you couldn't rip it off.
Wow. Wow. Man, that's a bold statement. But I mean, really, when things are in the back of a van or on a bus and getting thrown around, and, you know, maybe your drums fall over and they get hit by something, it's nice to know that you're putting your very, very valuable and a lot of times rare drums, you know, out in the world in a cheap case. It doesn't make sense. So it seems like there was a need in the market for this and you filled it. And let me ask this. So technically you were covering and putting the tape on the inside and all this stuff to avoid there being any kind of like sharp-ish edges, like the zipper or anything touching the right. drum, correct?
The zipper was totally had flaps over it, and the what's where it was sewn, you know, you have ragged edges. We put that binding tape over it, and that way it couldn't shred and come apart. Everything was covered.
That's great. Were you called tuxedo bags at that point, or had you had that name yet?
Yes. At that point, the logo, it said tuxedo gig bags. And we had a little bow tie under the logo.
Yeah, cool.
And also to make the bag, I always wanted it to look good and work well, but I knew a lot of times appearance is a lot. Instead of just having a little paper label or something, you know, I actually got an embroidered patch made with the logo sewn onto each bag.
Yeah. I mean, it's attention to detail, which it's, I don't know. It all kind of works. Tuxedo, attention to detail, very sharp and clean, kind of not sharp literally, because you wouldn't have that. It'd be covered in.
Right.
And my
slogan at that time was formal wear for your axe.
Ah, very nice. It's true.
That was the tuxedo part.
And I almost think, I don't know, just the connection to Louis Belson, everyone thinks of a very well-dressed man who's a gentleman and, you know, it just all fits together.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing like him. We, you know, and then also we took a picture of Lou holding up the cymbal bag and the stick bag, and I put it on a hang tag. I put that picture on a hang tag on each bag and each item.
Yeah,
and Louis's signature was across the picture, and on top of that tag it said, caught holding the bag, Louis Belson.
I mean, if I remember correctly, you said Louis was not charging you. Louis is your mentor and buddy and was just happy to do it, right?
Absolutely. Ugh, I was so nice naive, guy. You know, when this thing started and you know, and Louis and I showed it and we took a picture and I said, can I put it on the tag? He said, yeah, sure, whatever. I was so naive that, you know, people like that have these big contracts, you know, with drum companies and cymbal companies and all that stuff. You know, Louis just said, yeah, let's do it.
Wow. Did not realize. I mean, you obviously probably would have been successful and quality is key and people would have seen that. But man, he really bumped you up.
Oh, having his picture on hanging on each bag.
Yeah. It doesn't get much bigger than that, especially in those days. Nowadays, you know, I mean, he's been gone for quite some time, so it might not, you know, people might say, who's this guy? But I feel like at that point, I mean, he was still, you know, a king, still is, obviously, but.
Well, it's pretty amazing to me and, you know, you being a drummer and knowing history. I mean, I run into somebody today, like even my wife, we were on a golf course. My wife ran into somebody a couple weeks ago and somehow drums came up and it's, oh yeah, my kid plays drums, you know, and this guy says, my wife says, do you know who Louis Belson is? And this kid, he didn't know who Louis was.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
the shame.
If we had YouTube TV years and years ago where you could pull everybody up and learn something and see these people. They don't know. Lou used to have a line all the time. You have to know where you're going, you have to know where you came from.
Yeah. Very true.
You studied those people.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, that's, I've had that where I'll post, you know, these drum videos and stuff, and I get some guys and girls who comment very frequently. It'll be like, oh man, I didn't know people could play like that back then. And it'll be like a Buddy Rich video.
Like,
you have a lot to learn. It's not all this. I mean, the people have been absolute monster drummers, and double bass didn't always exist. It had to come first from, you know, from someone.
From Louis.
From Louis, exactly. With the big four tom.
Louis is the originator of double bass drums.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And we'll talk more about Louis. But so I think we left off on the bags with, you were at the booth, you had people cutting and tearing and they couldn't do it, and all this stuff. So it was obviously you know, you were getting some attention, right?
I was getting some attention there, and you know, people didn't realize how small I was. I was shipping FOB my kitchen. You know what I mean? I didn't have any place. I had bags made up and shipped them out. Then I had to get a little warehouse, garage-size type warehouse, an office to store stuff, because now I had to have an inventory of all the different size drum bags. I had to have cardboard boxes to ship them in. You know, all that stuff, I started to learn. And I even got I had to get a loan from the Small Business Administration because all that stuff costs money. And I didn't realize it. You know, I mean, promotion and all that stuff and advertising. And the home I had at the time, I put up as collateral for that SBA loan. And that came into play later again, you know, but that's what I had to do to get this thing off the ground. And I didn't ask anybody for any money. I would never ask Louis for a dime. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure he would have helped me any way I wanted.
Sure.
And it's just the way I was. I was gonna do it. And it worked. I got a lot of attention at that NAMM show. And people were coming over and studying the bags. I had, it might have been the next NAMM show. I had these Japanese guys come over. They came to my booth like three or four times, and they stood there and they would talk to each other in Japanese, and they were holding the bags and looking at them and, you know, all this stuff. And I said, man, these guys are just going to rip me off. Well, it turns out on Sunday, the last day of the NAMM show, they came to my booth and gave me their card. They were Tama Drums.
Wow. Neat.
And they asked me if I would make that exact same bag for them in a different color.
Jeez, that's big.
And I said, yeah, that was big. I said, yeah. And I can't remember the size of the other, but they gave me an order. And what I did, instead of my tuxedo patch, I put a Tama embroidered patch on each bag.
Hmm.
And they loved the way it all looked.
Wow.
And they bought a bunch of bags from me. Maybe a year or so later, they didn't really stay with me because I figured they could copy it in Japan. You know, I was at that point. But they gave me a substantial order. A big music company in Hong Kong. I think Tom Lee is the biggest music stores chain. They ordered from me. Australia ordered from me. Germany. All of a sudden, people were ordering from me, and man, I'm in business.
Yeah, you're actually. I mean, it's so cool. I mean, you hear about that. It's almost like modern times. It's like these, like, you know, like on TV, like Shark Tank or something. It's like an idea that really. Right. Blows up. So with the Thomas stuff, what year was that happening? Because I mean, if it's, you know, 80s, 90s, that's really when the Japanese drums were just blowing up in general.
I'd say Tama was probably 83.
Okay.
Gotcha. Yeah, 82 or 83.
Interesting. That's and you were right there at the right time with those brands coming in and Simon Phillips and all these guys. That may be, I'm not sure when he actually came to Tama, but they really took the market. So like you said, though, you were first to market with this, which is obviously very important,
right.
But I'm assuming people did start to sort of encroach on your, you know, idea a little bit.
Some knockoffs did come out shortly after my first NAMM show appearance. a guy named Fred Beato made Beato bags. And it was actually a much cheaper version than mine. And also my bags, compared to what was out there, even in his, were the most expensive. I wasn't cheap because I used the best materials.
Yeah.
You know, I even got tags from DuPont to hang on each and each piece. You know, it said DuPont Cordura. You know, I wasn't hiding anything. You know, this is it. So Fred knocked me off a little bit, and he got some business. Because, you know, in the music industry, the store owners, they care about price more than anything.
Yeah.
They really do.
Sure.
You know, how cheap can you give it to me for? And the bag, Fred was, and yet even at the shows, when I would talk to Fred, you know, I never had any animosity toward any of these people. Hey, you know, do your thing, man. You know, this is mine. That's yours. Cool.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. And then with Louis, I also went to Remo. Now, you know, the odd shape of Rototoms.
Yeah.
Well, I designed and made up some bags to hold the Rototoms. And that really, they liked it, but it really didn't go anywhere because they didn't want to get into bags.
Mm.
And then also with Zildjian, you know, Armin, you know, because of Louis, you know, I had entries to everybody.
Yeah.
And I got to be friendly with, you know, with Remo and Lloyd McCausland at Remo and Armin Zildjian, who was a great guy, and Lenny DiMuzio, who did all the, you know, the Zildjian artist relations things. And picked out everybody's symbols, you know, like if Louis needed symbols, he'd call Zildjian and Lenny DiMuzio would pick them out or, you know, and ship them to you, whether it was Louis, Buddy, any of those guys.
But like, obviously you yourself are a likable, nice guy. And that connection and mentorship basically led to your friendship with Louis, which Louis's really great relationship and friendship and being a nice guy with these companies led to your ability to have these connections and have that trust. So it just kind of comes back to like good business and being nice to people and down to human relationships. Because without that, you wouldn't have gotten anywhere. Louis wouldn't want to be around you. You know what I mean? Like right.
Oh, absolutely.
It's pretty powerful stuff.
You know, there's three things that I point to in all the years of my relationship with Louis, and I'll throw them in here early, and we'll get back to some of the other stuff. But one of them was Louis being best man at my wedding.
That's awesome.
You know, and then when he was pretty old, like it was 2004, maybe, he did a concert of sacred music he premiered up in Northern California. And my wife and I flew up there and surprised him. And at the end, you know, when you introduce people and you thank the orchestra and all that stuff, he introduces me in the audience as someone who's been with him over 40 years. And, you know, I mean, that like, I was crying, you know, I mean,
yeah.
You can't beat that. And that's on YouTube if anybody wants to look it up.
Wow.
It's called Louis Intro of Ron and Charma, you know.
That's awesome.
And then I was pallbearer at his funeral.
Mm.
And that's 3 milestones for me.
Yeah. Clearly, he was a great friend to you, obviously. And I mean, just the business thing. So, you know, rewinding a little bit here. So you were like, I guess personally, I should ask, was this was your job? Like your 9-to-5 job was tuxedo bags because you were full
at that point
business. Okay. So before that though, I'm assuming, you know, you had other jobs and stuff going on. What was your like trade, you know, that you would be, I mean, obviously you're a drummer.
Drummer, you know, originally. And then when I got to Vegas, I was working, I got there, Wayne Newton brought me there.
Oh, cool.
And there was he had a management company. This is 1971. I met him. Wayne was a guest. Louis had known Wayne because he appeared in his show at the time. But 1970, Wayne was a guest on the Pearl Bailey show on ABC TV, Pearl being Louis's wife.
Yes.
And at that point, I had left New York. I finished it at Berkeley and went out there, and I was working as Louis's assistant on the Pearl Bailey show. And Wayne was a guest, And I got to meet him, and they had a, he had a management company at the time for different acts. And they were putting a, like a, in those days they had what's called show bands, you know, and you'd go around the country playing all the Holiday Inns, Ramada Inns, you know, in Vegas. And they called me to see if I wanted to play in one of those bands. And I said, yeah, I'll do it. So I joined that band. And then I moved to Vegas a couple years later. And then I eventually I stopped playing. I said, I got tired of the road. I got a little beat up mentally on the road. Mm-hmm. And I had this 1973, I had this girlfriend whose mother was dating a pit boss in a casino. She says, hey, you want to be a dealer? I go, hey, yeah, I'll do that.
That's
you know?
Awesome.
And he, and in those days, to get anything in Vegas, it was all juice, who you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And he puts me in as a 21 dealer. And before you know it, after 25 years, I did everything from break-in dealer to casino manager.
Wow.
I ran the opera in strip casinos.
Cool.
So I had a great career there too, but didn't stop playing. You know, I played once in a while and practiced. And, you know, my relationship with Louis was still solid all those years. And that was my most of my time in Vegas.
This episode is brought to you by Forks Drum Closet, Nashville's full-line drum store. Celebrating its 40th year in business, Forks is independently owned and operated in the heart of Music City. Specializing in drums and percussion, Forks offers great discounts on all major brands and will beat any retailer's advertised price. From new and used equipment, vintage drums, and marching and orchestral instruments, Forks has something for every drummer. They also offer professional rental, repair and restoration services, as well as drum lessons. Stop by their storefront at 308 Chestnut Street, Nashville, Tennessee. Call 615-383-8343 or go online at forksdrumcloset.com. This episode is brought to you by Nicky Moon Custom Cymbals. Nicky Moon Custom Cymbals are premium quality boutique cymbals handmade in the USA. Nick Marguerite, owner and craftsman, is a classically trained professional independent cymbalsmith with over 10 years experience who has traveled all over the world studying with masters and working in cymbal factories to perfect his craft. Nicky Moon offers a wide range of fully customizable series and models to choose from, including Sentinel, Dirty Angel, Custom Shop, Stainless Steel, and the critically acclaimed One Series. Nicky Moon also provides full-service cymbal modification and repair services. Any old cymbal can be sent in, reworked, and reimagined into something completely new and different. The possibilities are endless. Get in touch at nickymoon.com. And all Drum History Podcast listeners can get 10% off their next order by using coupon code DRUMHISTORYPOD. That's DRUMHISTORYPOD. Go to nickymoon.com, NICKYmoon.com to learn more, and follow him on Instagram at @NickyMoon_cymbals. All right, now getting back on to tuxedo bags. All right, so you were starting to get ripped off. You said Beato, which I've always called it Beato bags.
Yeah, I didn't know if it was Beato. I called it Beato too, but I think he's Hispanic. I think he calls it Beato when he as his name because that's his last name.
Sure, sure. There's so many names where people Tama, Tama, Paisty, Pasty, Beato, yeah. Beato. All right, so then. What happened from there? You know, you're kind of, I think you said mid-80s, let's say you're getting kind of ripped off a little bit, but you're going strong. Right. You're working with Remo, you're working with Zildjian. Take it from there.
Yeah, well, actually, I made a bag for Zildjian, and they liked the bag, but Zildjian was really growing commercially at that point, even though everybody loved Zildjian. You know, all of a sudden they went, they got a, you know, a president, and, you know, all of a sudden they were, it wasn't just Armin running the company anymore. You know,
yeah.
It was all these corporate suits. So then they came out with the Zildjian bag, and it was different than mine, but they didn't, you know, that didn't go anywhere. But, you know, but I did show them the bag, and I stayed very friendly with Zildjian through the years after that, even just, you know, as friends. There was a time in 1979, Slingerland Drums had the Louis Belson National Drum Contest. For best drummer, 18 and under, which Louis had won when
Gene
he was
Krupa.
17, the Gene Krupa contest.
Yeah.
Well, they put together the Louis Belson National Drum Contest when he went with Slingerland then in 79. So and I remember the finals were in Vegas, and we're at this reception, And I'm standing there, I'm talking with Armand and Lenny. Do you know Lenny D'Amuzio, who he is at all?
No. Okay. I feel like the name has probably come up, but not off the top of my head, no.
He also has a book out called Tales from the Cymbal. He died just a couple of years ago.
Okay.
Tales from the Cymbal Bag. All his stories with people. And, you know, he was the artist rep and everything for, I don't know, 30, 40 years.
Wow, I'll have to check that out.
So he's the guy.
Cool.
And there's actually a picture in there of me with Louis and Wayne in that book. But so we're standing around talking, and Armin says to me, have you seen these new, I think they were the quick beats, the hi-hats with the holes in the bottom cymbal?
Yeah, I think quick beats. I think new beats, no hole.
Okay, so Armin says, have you seen these quick beats? I go, no, I haven't seen them yet. He says, yeah, look, he says, they got these holes in the bottom. They're really nice. He says, what are you playing these days? And I said, well, I'm using a 20-inch, you know, ping ride and an 18-inch medium ride and a 16 crash and everything. He says, yeah, okay, that sounds good. Well, 2-3 days later, there was a package at my door, a whole set of cymbals from Armand Zildjian.
Wow.
I mean, how do you beat those guys? Those old school guys.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Just amazing.
That is just so cool. I mean, a set of cymbals now, then, whenever is expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a nice little perk but you're an industry guy at that point, you know? I mean, you're
at that point, right?
Yeah.
But I was still playing. He says, you're still playing? I go, yeah, once in a while. He says, what are you playing? And I told him the sizes, and that's what he sent me.
Good memory too, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's Armand was great. And even over at Remo, when I would hang out with Lloyd McCausland, who was the guy that ran all the production and stuff at Remo, you know, he made sure, you know, I told him what drums I had. And, oh, I got a box of drum heads from Remo. You
that's know, awesome. Louis is Mr. Remo. I mean, as far as I know from doing previous episodes, I mean, he was like a stockholder with Remo. I mean, he's all about it.
He was listed, I have his business card, as vice president. But that was because, you know, when Remo started, Louis actually probably funded him to start Remo.
Mm. Man. Louis has his, you know, his legacy kind of spread all around the place, which is great. So,
absolutely.
All right. Well, keep going from there.
Well, at that point, I'm in business now about 4 years, and I'm just trudging along. And I went back for more advice to the Small Business Administration, and they said, "Well, at this point, you know," I said, "I need more marketing and advertising and promotion." And they said, well, you need like $250,000 for marketing. You got to take out ads. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to reach all these people. And I said, well, I can't get that. You know, I don't have it and this and that. So I'm figuring, well, I'm about to sell what I have and get out of the biz. Mm. So at the different NAMM shows, though, I had met and talked to Erwin Berg from Humesenberg.
Mm-hmm.
And they made road cases, you know, and they were the biggest company that made fiber cases for 50, because they had already been in business 50 years. Erwin Berg's father, Willie Berg, started the company over 50 years ago, and they made, you know, trumpet mutes called stone mutes. They're white with that red thing. That's Humesenberg mutes.
Wow, cool.
And that's where they started. And then they got into fiber cases and band equipment and stuff. So they're in business 50 years. And I got friendly with Erwin. We were just, you know, we used to tell jokes to each other. Erwin Berg, Ron Weinstein, two Jewish guys at the NAMM show would just, you know, laugh it up. And it was funny that he liked my bags, but didn't really want to know what to do with it. Well, I was home, I think it was in October, maybe 84, and I get a phone call like at 7 in the morning, and it was Erwin Berg. And he says, you know, hey, what are you doing? I said, nothing, I'm just trudging along. And in my head, I already was going to go out of business at the end of the year. He says, are you interested in any kind of, you know, me buying your product? I go, well, yeah, talk to me. You know, what do you got in mind? And again, I didn't really know from much. And before you know it, he says, let me get a contract going. And me, I was going to go, okay, you want to give me something? Fine, it's yours, you know? Well, all of a sudden I get this 25-page lawyer contract, you know, with all these ins and outs. And, you know, I said, yeah, okay, it's yours. You know, he paid off, they paid off the loan that I had with the SBA, and he got all the designs. But by that time also, I was making guitar bags and trumpet bags, saxophone bags. And they took all the designs, and they owned it all, and they were going to make it. And I just had to appear at the next couple NAMM shows at their booth as a representative. And that was it. He, come January, at the next NAMM show, it was Humes and Bergs tuxedo bags.
Man. I mean, you sound like you're just a very, I don't want to say, I guess, like happy-go-lucky kind of guy. Were you at all like, this is my baby, I'm getting rid of it? You honestly don't sound like, you sound like you're like, I had a great time, I had a good experience, and I was kind of done with it. Did you have any, what were your emotions like with that?
My emotions were, it wasn't like I was done with it. I really loved it. Like you said, that was my baby. But then I said to myself, well, here's a situation. Humes and Berg has been in business over 50 years. You know, they don't have to sell to distributors. They sell direct to every music store. They sell direct to every school system, you know, band risers, band equipment, all that stuff, bandstands. I said, well, who better to take this where it can go? I couldn't take it to the ultimate, and they could. And so it was like a natural. I was proud that they did it, and I was able to get out of it without losing a dime, you know, and it was just fun. And at the time, I go to that next NAMM show with Irwin, and his son was there, Mike Berg, who runs it now. Mike was like 15 or 16. And we just teased him unmercifully, you know, Mike. And he's a great kid, and he's running the whole shebang now. Yeah. Irwin is pretty much retired. And what he's done with it now, I mean, those cases he puts out, you know, the hard cases.
Yeah, they're really cool.
They're great, and all the colors. And at the time, even Irwin, what he did to get Tuxedo produced, he still used a sewer in the United States, my sewer in California, actually. And then he set up his own sewing factory in East Chicago, Indiana, where Humes and Berg is. And then it got so big where he set up and still has his own bag company. They make the bag in China directly. And that's his, he's not having somebody in China make it. He set up his own sewing operation in China.
Wow.
And as far as soft bags are concerned, and they've made other types now, they got the tuxedo, they have the fuzzy kind, you know, they have different levels of soft bags now.
Yeah.
But basically, like the tuxedo bags are sewn, still sewn exactly the same way. And they're the largest gig bag company in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, if they were kind of known and are known as the hard cases, then why not include the most high quality soft bag under the umbrella? So I think you obviously chose the right, you know.
Yeah, it was a natural extension for them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. I mean, and it sounds like you had a great time. And like you said, you had fun. You, I'm sure, could support yourself with.
Yeah,
as a job selling these cases, and boom, you're in the industry and all that stuff. So where does it stand today? Obviously, so Humes and Berg is still making them.
Oh yeah, they still make Tuxedo. If you look at on their website or the catalog, they still show it. You know, they, like I said, they make a couple other lesser quality bags, but pretty much sewn close to it. But the fabric and stuff is a little different. They have different price points for different music stores now. And Irwin, even a few months ago, called me up, you know, just out of the blue, hey, how you doing, you know? And if I see something that Mike posts on his Facebook page, I, you know, I always say, so hey partner, what's going on, you know? And even though I get nothing, you know, from them today, but you know, I did get some royalties for the first couple of years initially.
That's great, you know.
And but it was great.
I like that you also were like going to like the Small Business Association and asking for help and doing this stuff, because I think sometimes people forget that there are resources that are there to help you. And obviously they said you need a ton of money, and that kind of led to this. But just, you know, you can be just a guy, just a drummer, you know, who's not a you didn't go to business school for this stuff and get like an MBA. So
right.
It's pretty cool that anyone can do it, but it's obviously a lot of hard work. All you have to do is know one of the most famous drummers in the world who will open.
That was all. Yeah, that's it.
that's the only thing you need. But all right. So on that note, let's rewind. How did you meet Louis Belson when you were 16? I mean, how did your relationship with him happen?
Well, being a drummer from the time I was like, say 13, I had a snare drum and a hi-hat and a cymbal. When I turned 16, the day I turned 16, my oldest brother co-signed a little note for me at the local music store in upstate New York, where I'm from. And I got a Rogers set because my favorite drummer, just listening and watching, was Louis Belson. Mm-hmm. And he played Rogers then. And I got a Rogers set. And then at that point, I got a job, and the music store let me pay $25 a month till it was paid off. In those days, drum set was, you know, $300 for a Rogers set. You know. So I did that, and I was playing. So now I was 16. A little later, that was in May. A little later, October, I get my issue of Downbeat magazine in the mail. And on the cover was a picture of Louis Belson. It says, Louis Belson back with Duke. And I just, wow, hey, that's great. And I look in my in the New York newspaper, coupled within a few days or so, and I see coming to Basin Street East, a famous nightclub in New York City, Duke Ellington and his orchestra. Hmm. Well, I figured, well, that's, man, if Louis is back with Duke, I'm going. I lived about an hour north of New York City at the time. And at that point, I said, well, I want to go see Louis Belson. So my father took me, we drove into the city to Basin Street to see Louis Belson. And there it was. We got a seat. In those days, you know, nightclubs, yeah, he had a stage, and there was just like long tables that emanated from the stage. But we sat right in the front, right in the middle, in front of Louis' drums. And I'm waiting. I can't wait to see Louis Belson. And I see there's a swinging door towards the rear of Basin Street where the musicians are starting to come out. And there's no curtain at this club in Basin Street. The musicians are coming out and putting their horns on the stage. So I said, I'm going to go through that door, see what happens. I walk through that door and I literally physically bump into Louis Belson and Duke Ellington.
Oh boy.
They were talking. And I started stammering. I said, oh, Louis, I said, I came a long way to see you tonight, you know, and, you know, this is great. And, you know, little did I'm ignoring Duke Ellington.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, and then I turned to him, I said, Mr. Ellington, could you have Louis do a drum solo? I'm asking Ellington. And, you know, he didn't say anything. And then I talked to Louis, and then we got a typical club camera girl in those days came back and took a picture of me and Louis. Hmm. Not with Duke, though. I wish I would have had that in there. But it was just me and Louis, and I'm holding the sticks, and he's holding the brushes, you know, and we got that picture taken.
Wow.
Now I go back out to the club. I sit there, and here comes, now the show starts. The opening act was a very, very young, nobody knew, Joan Rivers. And after, then Ellington plays, and then Mel Torme was coming out to sing. But so I'm watching Ellington, and I'm flipping out because Louis's right in front of me. And, you know, if you've seen videos of Louis, his personality, always smiling mm-hmm. and looking at people. He just emanates. And they played Skin Deep. And that totally knocked me out. Now, when that show is over, I follow Louis off stage and go back there, and we start talking again. And, you know, I tell him what a big fan I am and all that stuff. And, you know, when I want to see him. He gives me, this is Louis Belson. Oh, I showed him a picture of me on my Rogers set, a little Polaroid, and he signed the back of that for me.
Wow.
And then he gives me his home address and phone number in Southern California.
Wow.
Who does that?
Yeah, really?
You know? Hmm. So that was my entree to Louis. I would write him. Occasionally I would call. I had huge fear to call him because sometimes Pearl Bailey would answer the phone and she would frighten me to death. But he stayed in, he always responded to me if I wrote him something. And then he told me he was coming to New York. I can't remember if that time he was coming with Harry James Band or his big band at the Riverboat in the Empire State Building. It was a nightclub in the basement of the Riverboat. And, you know, would I come help him be the band boy? I said, well, yeah, sure. You know, I did that. So I would take the bus from where I lived into New York City at night. And I was there with Louis every night, watching him play every night. You know, another time he came into the city with Pearl Bailey. She was going to be on the Ed Sullivan Show. He called me up and said, yeah, he said, hey, I'm going to have a lesson tomorrow with Saul Goobin, who is the timpanist for the New York Philharmonic. Louis was going to have a lesson with him. Mm. He said, you want to meet me? I said, well, yeah. Again, I took the bus into the city. I met him there. You know, it just, our relationship grew for some reason. Of all the people that Louis meets,
yeah,
you know, why did he, you know, stick with me? And then he came in with Harry James Band. We did the same thing. We were on the road one time. We went to Philadelphia to do the Mike Douglas Show, all that stuff. Everything I did was with Louis for the next couple of years. Then I got out of high school and I said, well, I spent a year on the road with a rock band out of high school. And I said, well, I guess I want to go to Berkeley. Louis wrote a letter of recommendation and made a phone call to somebody in Berkeley. And there I was. I got into Berkeley without an audition.
Wow. Oh,
so,
man. The Louis effect.
You can't beat these stories.
No.
I mean, and so I spent 2 years at Berkeley and loved it. And then he told me that Pearl was going to get a TV show, ABC. I said, well, I'll come out and help. You know, I want to move out there. And he says, well, you know, it's real tough in LA these days. I said, I don't care what I do. You know, so I moved to LA in September of 1970 and was there as his assistant on the Pearl Bailey Show. And we'd be in the music office, and each week the guest stars would come in, like on Monday, and go over the music with Louis. And then the arrangers would make their charts, and then Friday there'd be a run through, Thursday, Friday, and then the taping Friday night. The guests that Pearl had on that show for 13 weeks, we had Ellington, we had Basie, we had Louis Armstrong, Mel Torme, Tony Bennett, Lucille Ball, Bing Crosby, everybody who was anybody was in Louis's office that week. You know, that I would get to hang with.
That's so cool.
And that was the end of an era.
Yeah. Yeah, those variety kind of, you know, those shows like that, where there'd be performers, they just, you know, they're so cool. There's, I feel like, kind of variations of it now, but it's almost more competition-based, and it's just, it was something special in those days.
And it only lasted, the ratings weren't bad on ABC, they said. The reason that they canceled it after just 13 weeks, it was too expensive for them to produce.
Yeah.
With all those guest stars.
Big names, and you're there for a week. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, there were stories I remember of guest stars. And I was always, it was one of the things that's funny, I was always like Louis's earpiece. You know, Louis meets, I mean, he would forget details. And I remember, this is now in 1970, beginning of 71, Joan Rivers came to guest on Pearl's show. And she went, she goes, oh, Louis, how you do? Remember, I met you, you know, 5 years ago, whatever, you know, from 65. Yeah. And I lean over Louis, I go, Basin Street East. She was the opening act. And Louis goes, oh, yeah, Basin Street.
That's awesome.
And I was always doing that for him because I remembered all the details.
Jeez. Yeah, because for you, it's like a mind-blowing, once-in-a-lifetime thing. And for him, it's like, that's every day.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Wow.
So that evolved, you know, to my relationship with Louis, and we stayed close over the years. Every place I ever lived, whether it was a little apartment in LA or my little apartment in Vegas and then a house and then house, Louis would always come visit. You know, we were just like father and son. Hmm. It was amazing. I knew his sisters, his brother, It was just nothing like it.
Wow. I don't want to say lucky, because there's always the sayings of like, well, luck is made by hard work and by being in the right places and stuff. But it's really, you're right though, where you're like, why did he choose you? He obviously saw something in you, and you guys just got along. That happens sometimes with, if you're kind of quote unquote, I guess his assistant or whatever, he's got to like you and want to spend time with you. And
he had that relationship with others in different times, like with Dave Black, who was a music student out in Northridge, California, and also with Andy Weiss up in San Jose area. So he's had that in different periods of his life. Different people have come in and, to his life. But like he says in that intro of me that you can see on YouTube, we were together over 40 years.
Wow.
And it's hard for me to fathom that whole thing when I think back on it.
Yeah, exactly. And I do plan on doing, because on the show there have been biographies on other major drummers, but I'm working on one with Andy, and hopefully we can get you involved. A biography on Louis Belson. But Andy had some health issues with COVID, and we've kind of, we're going to do it when we can do it. Man, Ron, well, this has just turned into, this is the kind of episode that I absolutely love, just because it's not, your story is what it's all about. You know what I mean? It's a guy who worked hard and made a cool drum company, and it's full of all these great tales of drumming legends and Louis and all this stuff. I want to thank you for being here. And also, Ron, if you have a couple extra minutes, I figure we could maybe hang out and do a little bonus episode for Patreon, where maybe we talk a little bit more about, I always like to do on the bonus ones, like the behind the scenes a little bit on some trial and error, and maybe some things that you tried where, hey, this prototype didn't work at all, and maybe there was a couple flubs here and there. I like to hear about that kind of stuff, and we'll see what else comes up. So, for people listening, if you want to hear that bonus episode, you can go to drumhistorypodcast.com, and there's a Patreon button, which you click, and $2 a month and up. There's other perks, but you get those bonus episodes. And a big thank you to Greg Chadaranek. I'm going to have trouble with that last name for the rest of my life. So thank you to Greg Ron, as you know, he read your story online, and then boom, it led to this a year later. So you never know.
Well, thanks for having and listening to the story. I love talking about it, because everything that's happened over the years has just been like almost like a fairy tale to me, and I don't take any of it for granted. There's lots of Louis stories, and one day when you do a Louis biography, we can really get into some more.
Yeah. I'm sure it'll be a two-parter kind of episode, because there's a lot of people who love the gentleman who is Louis. So I'm glad we could incorporate him in this episode. Everyone can check out the bonus episode where Ron and I are going to take a few minutes and talk. Ron, thank you so much for sharing your story. I know people are going to love this one. It's been great. So, and I do want to say too, I don't know when this is going to come out, but the day we're recording this, Charlie Watts passed away yesterday. Today's August 25th. He passed away August 24th. So we just want to say, that we love Charlie Watts, and we're sorry to hear about it for the band, everyone.
Another gentleman.
Exactly. I was fortunate enough to meet him in 2019, which will always be one of the most important memories in my life. So thank you to Don McCauley, who has been with Charlie for a long time as his tech. So I just wanted to say that. So anyway, on that note, thank you, Ron, for being here. And I look forward to the bonus episode. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you. Thanks again for having me, Bart.
If you like this podcast, find me on social media at Drum History, and please share, rate, and leave a review. And let me know topics that you would like to learn about in the future. Until next time, keep on learning.